know, these episodes that we're doing came out of like a COVID era Instagram Live and YouTube Live that we were doing. So the podcast method just kind of...
Well, everybody went virtual and there was a need to communicate.
Right.
But what you and Michael are doing, you know, it's great. You're just, you know, you're just doing it in a very sort of straightforward way. And that's a real accomplishment, I think.
Don't ask me how it happened. There was no plan for any of this stuff.
One day at a time.
Yeah, right. Well, it's funny. I think that's a pretty good segue. You know, it seems like your career spans all these different things and it's kind of unconventional too. I would love to hear, you know, everything about how you got started in making work, but also your work in education and the Stewart Collection and, and all that kind of thing, artists you've worked with. That's one of the things, getting to know you, sharing stories about working with artists. It's something I connect with, and I know Michael from Ice Gallery. We all sort of connect with that type of thing. So I would love to know more about your background, where you're from. And
sure. Yeah, I'll give you a 25-cent version of my life story.
Right.
But I grew up in a French family in New York City. I was sent off to boarding school when I was pretty young, about 13, and sort of wasn't back home after that, and ended up in college in Chicago at University of Chicago for about a year and a half and quit. I was taking classes kind of all over the place, and it wasn't really making sense, and I stopped and left University of Chicago, made really wonderful lifelong friends there, and have visited and been back there since, but ended up on a long voyage with one of those guys through Europe and into the Middle East and Central Asia.
What year is this?
This is sometime around mid-70s, early to mid-70s, and we were, you know, I was 19 years old. And
wow.
We just kind of made our way across all those miles, all the way through then Yugoslavia and northern Greece and Turkey and into Iran. And,
no way.
Through to the far end of Iran, and had run out of money at some point, and were, you know, fairly desperate and were completely ignorant about the culture there and missed.
Were you just hopping in cars or buses or trains, or did you have
all
like
of the
one?
Above? We paid occasionally for a train, and we were trying to wave, you know, cars down, and truck drivers were really helpful. We spent, I remember this one little town called, I think it was east of Tehran, called Miami. And we were there for like 3 days, and we were sort of got completely integrated with our surroundings in this way. We were these nutty, you know, kind of hippies.
Yeah.
But we weren't an unknown quantity. I mean, a lot of people like
of
us
course.
Have been through there.
Yeah, and I can really relate to that too. Same with me when I was 18 or 19. We went hitchhiking to San Francisco. This is in the early 2000s, so like we knew of everybody that came before us doing exciting trips as young people, you know, just going for it.
Mm-hmm.
My small version is we hitchhiked from San Diego to San Francisco and back to San Diego.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was no world traveling trip like you just described, but I get that bug, you know, like that feeling of wanting to do that.
Well, it really opened things up. I mean, it was just wild. And to be... You know, our ignorance in a way was a kind of bliss because we were so open to everything. We ended up in Mashhad, which is at the very eastern end of Iran, and then entered into Afghanistan, but were turned away because it was the first Soviet-engineered coup or some political development in Afghanistan made it such that Americans were not welcome, and so we were told to leave or go around.
So this was
Pakistan.
you and how many people?
Me and one other guy.
Wow, that's amazing.
This
Are you
guy.
Still friends with them?
Oh yeah, we see each other. We've actually had these wonderful get-togethers lately, Now that we've reached a a certain age, and it's been really fun. Get-togethers over Zoom and
wow.
So
did you have the art compulsion back then? Were you studying art in Chicago? Were you doing anything like that?
No, I didn't take a single art class. I took various classes, a lot of graduate courses that you would never be allowed to take now. Mm. I don't think anyway. Certainly not at UCSD where I teach. You can't just jump into advanced courses, and it turned out to be just not productive. There was no kind of focus or discipline to it, and my parents I was wasting my father's money basically. And
what did your parents do?
What were their occupation?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My father was a lawyer. They're both French originally. They were both immigrants, and he was quite old when I was born. He was
During World War II, or when
they came, my mother sort of came in the 30s as a young woman with her family, or even earlier. I mean, she's probably the late 20s, and so she was sort of educated on both sides of the Atlantic. And then my father came in the 40s, getting away from the war.
Mm-hmm.
My father has this crazy long story that we're not going to have time to get into.
A podcast can be any sort of length. We can do a long episode, but
yeah.
Share as much as you want.
Well, when I left college, my father said, all right, you're on your own, and I'm not paying for anything more. And that seemed like a fair deal. And so I spent several years just traveling. In fact, including this country, we had this crazy experience going back and forth through Iran and back into Turkey, and we were prevented from crossing the border because of some bureaucratic issue that made us go all the way back to the center of the country, to Tehran, to get it solved. And we were helped out by, number one, by Muslim sense of helping people,
mm-hmm.
just in a very ordinary way, not as a sort of, not like, it's just sort of a requirement that if somebody's in need, they get helped. And
mm-hmm.
And that was a revelation. That was something that wouldn't have happened in this country.
Right.
And then ended up doing similar stuff, sort of odd jobs, back when I finally got back here a year later. And
did you come back to New York, or where did you end up?
Back to New York, back to Chicago for a bit, and traveled around the country quite a bit. In fact, the first time I arrived in San Diego, which was way before I ended up living here, I arrived on freight train ended up in one of these SRO hotels mm-hmm. down the gas lamp, when it was like a gas lamp, when it was a sort of occupied by sailors on leave and
right.
not anything like what it is now. So. And then I settled in. I did have some ideas about working in stained glass somehow, found this artist who was doing that up in Canada, sort of long story short, ended up in Portland, Oregon.
Cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Portland's amazing. My family's all from Portland, and
mm-hmm. really.
Yeah, my grandmother and mom, we lived there for a little bit when I was a kid. It's a beautiful place. I haven't been there in a while, but
yeah, this was late 70s,
mm-hmm.
let's say, and I did manage to finish college there, and I did take art classes, and I did sort of become an artist there, and started working. But then I have never been to grad school, and my grad school was getting out of college. I didn't really have a way of making a living other than with my hands,
mm-hmm.
and started remodeling houses, and then figured out a system for the construction of what they called cycloramas for photographers.
Mm.
So this is back in the days before Photoshop. Commercial photographers needed a studio and a wall that they could light in however they wanted and drive a car or a tractor trailer or
right.
models or whatever in there. And so these walls curved into the floor and curved into each other and into the ceiling.
Right.
And I was this kind of can-do young guy who figured out how to build them for several of these photographers in Portland, and then became then got connected with a wonderful organization that no longer exists, hasn't existed since the 80s, called Portland Center for the Visual Arts. Mm-hmm. And I became their, basically their preparator. Mm-hmm. And worked very directly with various artists who came through there. And those skills came in handy for artists like Jim Terrell, for instance.
Yeah, when you were describing those spaces, the photography spaces, I've installed a few of those Terrell spaces with the curved floors and things. So.
And these apertures that created this unique sort of situation where you had you could look through them and there was a sense of the sort of thickness of air. So various artists came through that were really interesting and that then hired me to do more stuff. Wow. Vito Acconci was one of them.
Wow.
Dennis Oppenheim, Mary Miss, briefly, and others. And so those ended up being these mechanical projects. At the time, Vito was building these crazy machines. And
he was a great artist.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He was an amazing, he's a poet, for starters. And then he would think through his work in words. You know, the first step in his development of his ideas was always kind of literary. Mm-hmm. And I was, really interested and willing and ended up building some things for him in Europe.
Wow, no way.
At Documenta. And,
wow.
Yeah.
So you, just by through being a preparator at that time at, did you say it was a Portland College Gallery?
It was this alternative space that was started by artists in Portland.
What was it called again?
Portland Center for the Visual Arts.
Okay.
And they would, essentially their mission, or sort of unstated mission, was to bring internationally known artists to Portland.
Wow.
And give them a license to do whatever they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes it was a show.
You know,
it was a show that came, Robert Rauschenberg, Roy Lichtenstein showed there. At one point I filled a truck with Lichtenstein's paintings and took them back from Portland to the Hamptons, where he lived. These paintings that are now, worth whatever, untold millions. So I was just doing all kinds of stuff, and it became exhausting. So I started making my own work around 1980. I got a couple of commissions. I was fortunate in Portland to get some commissions for drawings and installations. Mm-hmm. The installations were kind of temporary. But my first efforts at being an artist were up there in Portland, and this other work just became too exhausting. It was just
preparator work.
Well, building these things.
Right.
I don't know if it was exactly being a preparator because it wasn't tied to an institution. It was just these artists doing these projects that were, travel to Europe with a toolbox and deal with language issues, although my first language is French, so France was no problem, but Germany was a bit more difficult.
Huh.
German was actually how we communicated with people in Central Asia, in Iran, because there were so many guest workers. English wasn't spoken at all, but German was a kind of common language. So.
Wow.
So anyways, it became like too, I was like, if I'm going to be an artist, I can't be running around doing this stuff. And it was just too crazy and too unpredictable. Jobs would come and go and it wasn't, it was very well paid in a way, but not in a way that, could afford the kind of stability where I needed to be in a studio. So, so I sort of had this opportunity here in San Diego, and the opportunity came through Mary Beebe, who was the director of that Portland Center for the Visual Arts, and came down here to UCSD for the Stewart Collection.
Oh, I see. I didn't know Mary Beebe came from the Northwest.
Yeah, so she asked me to come down and just initially do this one project for Nikki de Saint-Fat, which was this kind of wonderful revelation for me, because it was like coming home in this way, because Nikki's work was so European. She's French. She was relatively unknown in this country, and her work was, you know, figurative and colorful, and mm-hmm. all these things that artists like Terrell and Irwin and yeah. others were not. Yeah. It was a sort of breaking free from a kind of code of minimalism.
So you were asked by Mary to come work with Nikki on a project here. Is that what you
right.
just said?
It was the first commission she'd done in this country, first commission done for the Stewart Collection, mm-hmm. and it's called The Sun God, and it's up there at UCSD, mm-hmm. and it, you know, was it had to be, the sculpture itself was fabricated in France mm-hmm. By a company called Haligon, H-A-L, Haligon, that had actually, that same family, went all the way back to the 19th century. They had done castings for Rodin,
and wow,
that's
amazing.
It was this sort of family business, and what they did was take a maquette at I think 1/5 scale and or maybe it was a 10th scale, and scale it up to create this huge fiberglass bird and do it very accurately, but mechanically with a pantograph. So they were basically burning away like styrofoam, and then laying up fiberglass on top of it, and then taking away the fiber, the styrofoam, doing it in parts, and fastening everything together and stabilizing it with a steel frame, and then the construction of the pedestal for this thing was very unique. It was done as a collaboration between Nikki and Jean Tingley, who was her partner and husband throughout her whole life.
I had to pull up a picture to jog my memory. I've seen it a million times, but the Stewart Collection and also Nikki's work in San Diego, I had trouble placing it in my mind because mm-hmm. she has other public works around.
She does. She ended up moving here. She suffered horribly from rheumatoid arthritis that was, I think, made a lot worse by her early work in fiberglass. Mm-hmm. And she ended up sort of in her through the last, you know, 10 or 15 years of her life living here in San Diego. So there's a lot of her work around, but at the time that was the first thing in this country.
Her show that they just opened the new MCASD with was just, you know, it hit me really hard because I've always known her work growing up in San Diego, seeing it at Balboa mm-hmm. Park as a kid or whatever, a convention center or UCSD, and, you know, not knowing, you know, everybody in San Diego, we all live around her work, whether people know it's her work or not. So mm-hmm. MCASD finally, like, kind of bookended it for me and helped me understand, you know.
Her whole history was amazing.
Yeah, incredible.
She's just an extraordinary woman. You know, she was, she came from a pretty aristocratic family, both American and French. And she was like a top model for a while. She was on the cover of Vogue. Hmm. She was fearless. She fell in through Tingley, who was completely the opposite of her in terms of background and mm-hmm. economic and everything. This incredible Swiss artist who made these falling apart machines. And the two of them collaborated throughout their lives. They were married, but then ended up living separately, but remained married for the rest of their lives. And were just this wonderful, like, collaboration of opposites and worked together. Like, probably the most famous thing is the Stravinsky Fountain in Paris that they created together.
And I don't know.
Even the piece that's at UCSD, he helped her figure out the pedestal for it. They were just constantly open to each other.
So did you stay on full time at UCSD to help with the collection or the new collection?
I wasn't full time. I was occasionally full time, but I, over all these years since, have worked as a consultant to UCSD for that. So I was not a staff person at UCSD. That's the way it evolved, you know, and gave me quite a bit of freedom so that I could, you know, step away.
Yeah.
The commissions, and there are now something like 23 of them, I think, that are part of the Stuart Collection, all of which I managed and mm-hmm. developed and worked on with Mary. Those have, you know, they would involve intense work for a period of time, a few months, and then much less work. And mm-hmm. so the consulting thing is sort of how it worked out.
Well, Isabel Dutra and myself were just at UCSD today doing a couple studio visits and seeing some projects, and we saw the Ann Hamilton pathway. I don't know how you refer to that piece, but it was cool to see that in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was an ordeal, I think, to get done. Mm-hmm. That I left the Stuart Collection about 2 or 3 years ago.
Uh-huh.
I got the Ann Hamilton going, and it was wonderful working with Ann.
Yeah.
It was a really complex piece and difficult to get done. There were, fortunately, others who stepped in when I left to get it done. It was all, you know, the stone came from Vietnam. It was fabricated in Wisconsin and came back to UCSD from there. There were incredible delays because it happened through COVID. Most mm-hmm. of it happened through COVID. And so that was the last piece that I was involved in.
So were you showing work this entire time from your... when you decided to be an artist and you said you got commissions in Portland?
Yeah.
And then you just continued to work since then?
Yeah, I did. And it's always been experimental for mm-hmm. me. You know, I've never been commercially particularly successful, but it's the commissions I've gotten have been, you know, very important mm-hmm. Over the years. And so the first one in Portland was just drawings. The city of Portland acquired about 20 or 30 drawings, and they're very simple line drawings, actually. Mm-hmm. So I would, they were in pairs. And that's kind of been the case all through my life as an artist, is it's one thing in response to another. It's, you know, there have been singular works that are just one-off things, but they're more conceptual. Mm-hmm. And these first drawings that I did in Portland were... there'd be on one side, there'd be this very simple line drawing that was made like with ink and a stick, and these very sort of delicate lines, and just hand drawn, so mm-hmm. they're sort of rough. And then the drawing that accompanied it, or that was its partner, was what I thought of as a plainer line drawing. It was made with oil paint that was a masked off shape, mm-hmm. always very simple. And then oil paint sort of screeded so that it created this this blocky line. Mm-hmm. And the two were intended as playing off of each other. They were sort of opposite in this way, but they reflected each other. They didn't repeat each other, but they were complements mm-hmm. of each other.
I think just recently, maybe, did you tell me you went back and visited, and they have it in a county office or a judge's office or something? Is that what it is?
You know, a few years ago, I was told, you know, these drawings, which I thought had just probably disappeared into the city's collection, mm-hmm. and who knows, were sitting in a storeroom or something, and I had framed them, and they were badly framed, and so, you know, I'd totally forgotten about them, and then I was told that these things had reappeared. And I went and saw them. They were beautifully reframed.
Oh, wow.
And they were in a courtroom, in a county courtroom. And it was because this judge, whose room it was, she had decided they were perfect. For her, she liked them for whatever reason. Well, for reasons that she then explained. So I visited and called them up and said, you know, I did these things and I'm curious to see them. And they immediately opened their doors and... and they were, that's all that was in the courtroom, as well as the jury room and some offices, were this whole collection of drawings. And what the judge told me was kind of wonderful, I thought, because these things were opposite, she had used these abstract images as a kind of explanation to juries that there are different ways of looking at the same thing. You know, you can look at things one way or you can look at things another way, and that's what you're going to have to decide as jurors. And so I was it's just really great, you know, to see these things still sort of in existence.
When did coming into doing more sculptural or site conditional type of work happen? Because you've done a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah. Too. So I get here to San Diego, and it's 83, 84, 85, and a friend here, Frank Cole, who was a grad student at UCSD, was just leaving the graduate program. We rented a whole building almost nothing, for $200 a month. Mm-hmm. It was a derelict building in the Gaslamp. Uh-huh. And this was at the time, the Gaslamp was sort of a slum.
Yeah, do you remember what street?
It was on 5th and F.
Okay.
It was on 5th, just around the corner from F Street.
Yeah.
Opposite the William Penn Hotel, where I imagined I had stayed as a vagabond. Mm-hmm. 10 years earlier.
Yeah.
We worked there for 5 years. I had the top floor. It was 2,000 square feet.
No way.
And the things I did there were that's where I started doing sculpture, basically.
So, did you know other artists in the Gaslamp at that time? It's kind of mm-hmm. like our own San Diego art history kind of thing. A lot of artists were in mm-hmm. the Gaslamp area, in the Broker's Building or in the church lofts on 10th and E.
Yeah, this was so long ago. It was sort of before the church lofts, I think.
But oh, wow.
I think the space we took over... Marjorie Nodelman, who had been married to Sheldon Nodelman, who was this wonderful professor, mm-hmm. art historian at UCSD, she was an artist, and she had had that space previous to us. Mm-hmm. And the deal was, you know, we'd just look out for the building. I mean, the people who owned the building were fine, but they, you know, it was an investment for them that they weren't prepared to remodel, and
right.
so... We were keeping the tramps and the pigeons out.
That's the classic story. I mean, that's the story of Ice Gallery, too, you know, passed down from artist to artist, and we ended up with it at some point.
Yeah.
You know? And I think a little bit of bread and salt, too, you know, like, mm-hmm. you know, you get artists in there, and they'll do their thing. And
well, yeah, because they're like, you know, cockroaches. Yeah. They'll survive.
Right, right. That's really funny.
And so the other artists were, I mean, Jay Johnson was one for
sure. Oh, cool.
Sure.
I haven't seen him in a really long time, but
no, he's out in Lakeside. I
live in Lakeside too. I've been wanting to go out to his house. I heard he built his studio out there, and it's just incredible.
He's a wonderful artist. He's a great artist. And I connected the first show I had here in San Diego was at Palomar College.
Oh, cool!
And that was maybe it wasn't the first thing, mm-hmm. but it was the first kind of installation work that I'd done in down here. And I did various sort of installations and imagined different things in this 2,000 square foot space. It was really fun. You know, I did these, it was a cross section of a Gothic church mm-hmm. In fiberglass that was sort of done rough, real rough. And I cast it on the floor. So it had the impression of the floorboards and then just suspended it. And it was like a structural cross section through a Gothic church.
Wow.
So it's a cross section of all the stone and the buttressing and stuff that supports the church, but it was translucent.
Huh.
And it looked quite beautiful. I built this other thing in connection with it that was a sort of opposite for it. That was an inverted black visqueen geometric form.
Mm-hmm.
That's just, it's hard to describe, but it came down sort of halfway down from the ceiling and you could walk through it. And so the upper half of your body was surrounded by this blackness.
Wow.
And it was enormous. It was like 100 feet long.
Wow. Isn't it incredible what giving an artist space can do?
Yeah.
It's wide open. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, it's crazy.
Yeah. And the freedom of it was great. Yeah. You know, people came to see it, but it was, you know, just this studio piece that I never exhibited anywhere else.
Right, so were you just doing open studios and, you know, making work, and you weren't treating it like a gallery, but you would have...
It was an experiment. The space was so rough, and various people came, and wonderful people came. Mm-hmm. I think Sheldon came once, and Ernie Silva came, and a partner at the time, Cora. She had opened a gallery. That was probably the first exhibit that I did in a commercial space in San Diego. It was a gallery that was short-lived and in La Jolla, mm-hmm. called Paris Green, mm-hmm. and she ran it. And what she showed were these objects, these kind of quirky objects that I was making. Mm-hmm. And then another early exhibit was a group show at UCSD at the Mandeville Gallery, mm-hmm. which still exists. That was a group show that included some luminaries like Chris Burden, mm-hmm. and the Lannan Foundation came through. I think her name was Bonnie Clearwater, who was the curator for it, and she saw that and got me to do something at the new Lannan Museum in Florida, and those things were individual sculptures. They were inverted. So if you imagine a plywood box that is finished on the inside with a white formica, mm-hmm. that's how these things were made. And they were like architectural forms. One of them was called Hatshepsut box, and it was the form of the Temple of Hatshepsut in Egypt. And I was just playing off of these various sort of plays of between geometry and architecture, sort of the idea of a model, but it's reversed, mm-hmm. and it had an architectural quality to it.
Wow.
Yeah. So those are the first things I did, and then the thing I just described, this cross section through a church.
Yeah.
I ended up casting that in concrete and placing it on the floor.
Whoa.
At Palomar College gallery, and I met a really great artist, Jim Skallman, uh-huh. who we ended up sharing that building also.
Oh, no way.
And we showed there at Palomar College. So this was, I think, 87, 88, something like that.
Yeah, Jim's a great artist, too.
He is.
Get to see him, you know, create work. He's just, you know, he's right in there building stuff and doing major mm-hmm. construction. And
yeah, he's another one. I mean, he and I, our work is different, but we share this idea about just, you know, taking working big, and experimenting at a large scale and doing it in some manner that is affordable. We ended up actually both doing projects at Art Park in upstate New York in this probably about 89, and we each of us built this big thing, spent the whole summer there.
I know you spent a lot of time working with Robert Irwin too on different things in the Stewart Collection, mm-hmm. or sounds like around the country too, right?
Yeah, Bob was the second artist to be commissioned mm-hmm. at UCSD.
The Running Violet V form?
Right.
Yeah.
It actually has no title.
Oh, okay.
And it's a misnomer because it is always called that, even I think on the Stewart website.
Right.
It's called this Two Running Violet V forms, and I'm not sure he ever approved that as a.
I was standing there looking at it today, just by this is random, you know, because we were there, but.
It's sort of a miracle how that thing has held up. The fencing is just as luminous as it ever was.
It still looks good.
It looks really good.
I've only known it for whatever, 15, 20 years or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know when they put it in, but.
It has this sort of autonomy. It stands, you know, it's totally itself. But it's in this forest that is actually not an actual forest. It's eucalyptus trees. They're planted in a grid. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a plantation of eucalyptus, which are not native trees. And he played off of that geometry. And it has this quality of being completely part of the grove. The mm-hmm. colors are, you know, this violet color is very much part of the presence of the eucalyptus trees, the bark mm-hmm. and the leaves. And then... so it's like totally integrated but totally separate at the same time. I think it's one of his best works. Irwin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a huge fan, so there's a million, but that's one that's memorable for me. I remember going to UCSD campus just as a kid. My mom, this is bad, and you know, we were like 14. She'd drop me and my friends off there to go skateboarding.
Oh, great.
And we would go, you know, skateboarding all around, and I remember going through the eucalyptus grove there and seeing the piece or going down the Alexis Smith,
that's great.
You know, stuff like that, you know, but And also seeing the Naumann piece there for the first time, mm-hmm. you know, as a teenager, just not, I didn't even know what art could be or was, you know?
So yeah.
It's a great introduction to all this weird stuff.
In the Stewart collection's been...
Including the Jenny Holzer.
Tremendous. Yeah. It's just been great. I think it was Mary's sort of a sense of openness that made it possible. There couldn't be two more different artists than Nikki Tsenfall and Bob Irwin, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of sensibility and you know, to go from Nikki to Irwin was just sort of, for me, sort of spells the diversity, the aesthetic diversity of that whole collection. Mm-hmm. And it's also, it's not easy art. You know, it's art that doesn't sort of explain itself in this way. And it's, it you know, you go through those things, even I can go through those things and feel differently about them at different times. Mm-hmm. People are always kind of questioning, you know, their validity or and they're always alive in this way, mm-hmm. because they're not easy, you know, mm-hmm. they're just they don't explain themselves, they're not art for hire, mm-hmm. they're art. The whole idea with the Stewart collection, which Mary and I, you know, really pushed, was to invite artists who were not from the world, necessarily from the world of public art, mm-hmm. who in many cases had never done a permanent work outdoors, and see what they would do, you know. Wow. And in most cases they were internationally known people, so it's been an experiment in the same way that what they do in the labs and studios across that whole campus,
yeah.
Is experimental. And the public art is experimental that way too, and hopefully will continue that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a memorable collection. It's incredible.
Yeah. And Irwin was just an immediate, you know, talking with Bob and debating with him and so on. And so he sensed, and, you know, he sensed that I could do things and help him do his work, and was sort of a live person who understood what he was doing and was willing to take it on and support it as well as argue with it. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up doing quite a few things. The first work he did at Marfa, I helped him do. That was quite a bit later. I did several projects.
What was the piece in Marfa? It's before the, I mean...
It was the piece that ended up being the permanent work that's there.
Yeah, Dust to Dawn.
Yeah, so we went and explored these falling down structures, and did the first steps there at Marfa.
I remember you telling me that you ran into Donald Judd there, mm-hmm. inside one of the pieces.
Yeah, inside one of the buildings. Ronnie Horn was the artist who was being shown. There were some objects by Ronnie Horn, mm-hmm. and my wife, Amanda Farber, who's also an artist, we were visiting. This time was not with Bob. I think it was even earlier, like it was mid-80s, I think. And when
Judd died in 94 or something,
yeah.
like that.
So we walked into this building. They were having kind of an open house, but it was before the days when Marfa became this sort of magnet for the art mob. And he was sitting there at the end of this building, and was just wonderfully generous with his time. He spent about an hour talking to us, and he was very proud of, you know, of not just what was on exhibit, mm-hmm. Which included Ronnie Horn and, I don't know, a bunch of other artists, but also these cartoons that he preserved on the walls that were drawn by German POWs. It was a POW camp during the war. Mm-hmm. And what I'd heard was that actually those POWs, when they got out, when the war was over, they didn't want to go back to Germany. They were saying, can we get a job here in Texas? But it was great to meet Judd.
Yeah, Marfa's incredible. I love going.
And the reason Bob has a presence at Marfa is because of Donald Judd, because he admired Bob's work and the sort of ambition and the risk involved in mm-hmm. Irwin's work. I ended up doing quite a few things for Irwin in Lyon in France, and Grenoble and Paris.
There was a survey. Did you do the survey in France?
I did, yeah.
I remember there's a documentary that covers the whole survey. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah.
It's so good.
So we did. So that was a sort of retrospective show that started in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And went to the museum, the Modern Art Museum in Paris, and involved a lot of his early works, all of his, you know, a representative selection from all of the cross-section throughout his career. And then he did a very expansive and ambitious a series of installations there that I helped him figure out.
Am I thinking of the one, there's these rooms with theatrical gels in the ceiling scrims that you go through the rooms and it starts to change colors?
A whole spectrum from orange.
Yeah.
You
helped install that stuff?
I didn't physically install it because it was a French entreprise, a company, private company that did the installations, but I sort of did all the coordination and translation and whatever and also help, you know, in solving problems, both mechanical and aesthetic.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been able to do for all these different artists, is deal with, understand the aesthetic aspect, the what the art wants to be and needs to be, but also make a connection with the nuts and bolts. And that's what I always have.
Have you always been that way, problem solving, or, you know, speaking an artist's language with other artists, or conveying that to the higher powers that have the money and stuff like that? I mean, I think it takes a certain type of person to relay a message sometimes, you know, if you don't get the tone right, it might
fall flat. Little bit of diplomacy is good.
Right.
But the insistence on what the artist needs is good too.
Yeah.
So that was, and with the Stewart Collection over the years, that was our best quality, was that we were 100% with the artist in terms of following through with their intention.
Right. Man, I love hearing that.
And even, you know, when things sort of didn't work out, being able to solve them. Like one of the much more recent artists, Mark Bradford, likes to say, you know, you only get really good at stuff when you can fix the things that you messed up, when you can fix your screw ups.
Right.
And he sort of learned that from being a hairstylist from his mom.
That's really funny.
Which she conveyed to him, you know, like you screw up sometimes, and you screw up on somebody's hair, you better be able to fix it.
Right.
And he cuts hair still, you know? And so, you know, sometimes the best work has come out of the not being able to do something and having to find a different solution or evolve it in some way that it will work.
We could talk about the Stewart Collection forever, but...
Yeah, we could. So through all that period, I was making, the project I did at Art Park, there's a great alternative sort of museum called the Mattress Factory in Pittsburgh, where I did a temporary commission work, these two rooms, and then I ended up getting there was a period in the about from 1990 to 2000 where I did a number of permanent commissions. There's one up north of here in Escondido at California Center for the Arts.
Oh, right.
A piece that's in the permanent work, which is called Blue Granite Shift, is in there at California Center. And it's it extends about, you know, 500 feet through into the center of this place. Insight, you know, recognized that I was doing this. That's how it was part of Insight.
I see. And Insight's making a comeback, I think, here soon.
Well, yeah, I'm going to Mexicali in a couple days to explore there.
Oh, yeah.
As part of that.
You are? That's incredible. I mean, we're in the gallery right now with Pablo Castaneda's show, so you guys are going to go around Mexicali. Are you going to go see?
I'm not. You know, it's a sort of conference or get together.
Oh, I see.
And a series of panels and different explorations that are all around this architect, Christopher Alexander, and Christopher Alexander was important to me way back then in the 80s when I was trying to. A big part of what I was exploring had to do with architecture. And Christopher Alexander and Peter Eisenman were the two architects who gave me a sense of a kind of a language of architectural form, mm-hmm. which is where my thinking has always kind of emerged from. And that they're both very important. Pattern Language was a book that Christopher Alexander wrote. He was sort of the opposite of Eisenman in this way. Eisenman was a very sort of rigorous kind of structuralist thinker, and Alexander developed all these ideas that were based around a much more feeling mm-hmm. sense, intuitive sense of the way architecture should be and wasn't. so he would build things and then take them apart because they didn't feel right. He would mm-hmm. drive contractors insane. And he had really interesting ideas about necessity of architecture uh-huh. and how modernist architecture had been, you know, a failure in so many ways because of its it ignored, you know, the sense of touch and humanity and scale and proportion,
yeah. right.
and, all those things that are like really important. Yeah. So they were part of my education for sure. You know, I never went to graduate school, and working with these artists and also just exploring the writings of these architects, that was kind of my graduate school for sure.
I'm definitely going to have to talk to you afterwards and get some of these book names that you just mentioned again. Yeah. But so you're still teaching at UCSD.
Yeah, it's unusual to be able to teach without having a graduate degree. Mm-hmm. My first shot at that was a full-time, year-long a job at UNLV, University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Oh, right. Yeah, we were talking about the double negative Michael Heiser piece because yeah. I went to Vegas just recently and I was saying I should have went and you said it was so close.
It's easy to get to. You know, you could almost drive there. You could drive there in a day easily
and come back.
From here. but so I got this opportunity and I kind of jumped on it because I, you know, teaching was a new challenge.
So you were in San Diego, but you were teaching at University
right.
of Las Vegas.
So I'd commute there and go there at the crack of dawn on Monday and come back late at night on Wednesday.
That is wild.
It was a great experience. Vegas is just a great town. You know, mm-hmm. it's just kind of wide open, but it's not very big, and the community, the art community there was quite wonderful. This guy Pasha Rafat, who helped me get that job, and others, and the grad students were great. I'd spend Tuesdays, you know, talking to all the grad students, mm-hmm. And Monday and Wednesday doing these classes, which at first was terrifying. I always had a real block speaking with groups, mm-hmm. Even, you know, my mouth would go dry, and I'd just be really nervous with a group of five people in a meeting where I had to present something, and it was sort of terrifying to have these smart young undergraduates and have a dozen or 20 of them to have to face them and put together something that really made sense. But in some ways, I think I was a better teacher then because I was so uptight about you know, just so. Working so hard at it.
Mm-hmm. And you liked doing it? That was your first time teaching?
I did. Yeah. I liked the students. And as I've gotten older, so I've been doing that like 25 years now at UCSD. I don't teach there full time, but I have this position called a continuing lecturer, continuing appointment. So mm-hmm. There's a sort of guarantee of a certain number of classes. And so it's a But the students are really the payoff. They and you know, my relationships, I mean, at this point they're like, you know, if I had grandchildren, they'd be possibly mm-hmm. that age. So they're in a wonderful place in their lives. They don't all feel that way. You know, some are having a really rough time. Mm-hmm. I think now, especially since these COVID shutdowns has been very difficult for a lot of young people.
I can't imagine what all these young people are thinking on these lost years of education, or
Yeah.
But so I guess that brings us kind of full circle too. I kind of started being able to talk to you while you were installing here at the building in Ice Gallery. So this is kind of an unconventional episode that we're doing. I mean, usually we just cover the Bread and Salt shows, mm-hmm. the Bread and Salt main gallery shows, but you know, with you being an Ice Gallery with Michael installing in there, you know, we've talked about all kinds of art stuff, but you've also brought in your students, and it's been incredible being able to share Bread and Salt with your students and answer questions. And
it's been wonderful for them. It was wonderful for them to come down. There's a trolley now that goes straight up to the middle of the campus.
Right.
And from just a few blocks away from here. So I thought, what the hell, you know, let's get them down here. And for a lot of them, it's the first time, their first time in the city.
Yeah. Well, you bringing your students down here, and you've done it multiple times, and you've worked with, you know, our artist at the time, Sophie Ramos, to have, you know, try to make a connection there. And we're always free and open so that, you know, you don't have to show a student ID or prove anything to come see our spaces. So,
well, and there's also the whole neighborhood here.
That's
a real revelation for people to get out of the trolley and then walk through the murals under the bridge.
Yeah, Chicano Park is the largest collection of outdoor murals in the country. It's pretty amazing.
Brilliant.
It's newly historic and, you know, recognized. So having a trolley is incredible.
Like Sophie Ramos couldn't be a more different artist than I am.
Right.
And I really like doing that. Running a class where you got work off of opposites as opposed to just trying to convey the, you know, my own aesthetic, which is what, you know, a lot of teachers basically do. And I think it helps also with the teaching that I have this, you know, really broad experience with so many different artists who think so differently.
Right.
And just be able to, you know, not be locked into my own thinking so much.
Yeah. I think, you know, the aesthetic of Ice Gallery and trusting an artist, and also Bread and Salt, we really want to trust artists to do what they do. And there was a really fantastic moment when Sophie was just tirelessly installing constantly her exhibition all the way up till the last day or afterwards. She was still thinking about how to continue to work on the piece. And I think, you know, there was a moment here where you were coming and working late and you were, you know, trying to just make your piece just so that in Ice Gallery, it was a really fantastic moment in the building where all these artists are working all around. And it is like that a lot, but that was a really special time in the last few months with your show.
So yeah.
Tell us about the piece so we can try to get some people to come see it.
So, yeah, there's not much time to come see it. I mean, I'd seen work here, Tom Driscoll and various other things. I had these linear forms in my studio, and I had a few of them, and I had some, that you see when you look at the installation that there are these three-dimensional lines that are basically linear forms that run from floor to ceiling. And then as you move around, there are similar lines that are, in some cases, reflections of them or projections of them on the wall.
Yeah.
And so it's this dialogue between two dimensions and three dimensions, the two dimensions of the wall and the three dimensions of the object running through space. And, you know, if you're looking through the windows or looking at photographs, you sort of can't tell the difference.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, that's the one thing, too, about Ice Gallery in the early version. We had big windows also that met the street.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, and so I think that's also why Michael gravitated towards that area to build it out, because those windows. So, yeah, with your piece in particular, I've been able to spend a lot of time with it, opening it for people or, you know, talking in there with you or whatever, so there's all these really beautiful moments as you walk around, whether it's outside on the sidewalk or coming in down the ramp and there's a window there to the front door and getting inside and, you know, doing that full walk
Walking
around.
Inside is the only way to really see it. But, you know, seeing it from different angles through windows, I guess, is possible. But the whole business is about the dialogue between existing in 3D space and 2D space. And you know, sort of vertiginous and illusionistic a little bit, but it's very real. And there's a kind of narrative that happens just from moving around. And then what was great was, you know, I sort of set it up, and then there was an opening and whatever. It was done, but it wasn't done because I've continue to come in, and that's been a great thing, the sort of openness of the possibility of coming in and changing stuff,
right.
or adding and just adding and subtracting things. And and part of the additions have been these detail elements, these lines that are very thin and
mm-hmm.
and that kind of come up from the floor and meet with other lines that come down from the ceiling, and that brings in another dimension where you sort of come in and see the detail, right? So you're not just looking in broad strokes, you're focusing on individual little things that are
happening. And there's also just something that you have to experience in the space, like, you know, just like you're saying, there's this real flatness to the quality of paint, and then, you know, there's also some really beautiful natural materials that you encounter in there, like found pieces of wood or
it's all like that. It's all junk. The wood is all eucalyptus branches that were laying on the ground from the campus, and the more geometric lines are these hardwood rippings that practically give away at this company, Frost Hardwood,
mm-hmm.
and they're laminated together, that was kind of a nice thing, just sort of assemble it from debris.
I love the mix of materials. It could be a vinyl material, a stick, adhesive vinyl,
the stuff on the wall.
Without giving it all away about what it is, but I mean, it's just so interesting when an artist has an idea and you can just grab from your toolbox in your mind of like what you need to make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So,
And being able to draw with tape is
right.
You know, you can work at large scale, and then it avoids all the thrash and hassle and necessary precision of masking and painting, which would have been a huge pain in the ass to do that. It's a kind of a big maquette in this way. It's fragile,
mm-hmm.
It's easily changed. You know, you can take things out and put them back in, and they're all kind of wedged between floor and ceiling.
Yeah,
and
that's
what really made it, when I walked in there and looked at these 16-foot ceilings,
right.
I thought, this is the only thing I really want to do here.
Right.
And these things had been in my studio and sort of lingered there, and I wasn't sure how I could use them. And
mm-hmm.
And so I just had the, you know, a couple sticks at beginnings of it in my studio, and so this is just really fun to
space is so interesting with the ceiling height that is almost a tapered ceiling. I think it's 16 at one end and a little bit less at the other.
So that's about 14 at the other end.
Right.
And then the 16 foot end is like 16 feet wide and 16 feet tall. It's a square.
Yeah.
And there's something quite beautiful about that.
Yeah, it's such a simple space, but totally complicated too. The floor has got tile on one side and concrete and all this, you know, natural
mm-hmm.
lighting and everything.
Yeah.
It's such a great space, and everything Ice Gallery continues to do is just the best.
And then he makes his decisions a little bit on the fly, you know, he comes and
as far as programming?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think
he knows what's going to happen
in 6 months or a year, that's for sure, right?
No, and I think that's the way to do it. You're always going to end up with, you know, quality. So some shows last longer as far as installation or
mm-hmm.
And then duration. But, I mean, I don't know. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think the thing that we all pay attention to is who shows up to shows and who's truly interested in contributing or participating in the space or the building. And you've always come to exhibitions in the building or Ice Gallery too, Michael. We all remember that kind of stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing worse than a cold pitch from an artist that's never been to your space.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
believe it or not, it happens more than you would think. It's
well, I think I've missed a lot of things too, that, you know, I've been to every exhibit, but it's it's also just being interested in stuff, you know.
Yeah,
just sort of like looking at what someone else is doing. And and you know, most of the artists that are working around here are younger than me, and it's kind of great to see this work that comes from other places and other sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole place is really fun to work in. I mean, it's relaxed. There's a big open space outside of what's called Ice Gallery,
mm-hmm.
and great guy Jason Lane is right there,
yeah.
and there's the Athenaeum that's right there, and
Really best practice and Quint won.
Best practice is a great. That guy's he's an artist, right?
Yeah.
And he's put together Joe Yordi. He's put together this operating gallery and so the environment is just really nice, and you can even get a cup of coffee now.
Provecho serving coffee. So, I mean, it's the coolest thing to me is that you'll run into one of your favorite local artists just hanging out at an opening or something.
Yeah.
I feel like Bread and Salt really is a place for artists,
All kinds of people from different walks of life come in and explore, and there's a kind of openness.
Yeah, the building's fantastic, and we're so happy to have you here, and I'm happy we got to talk today.
It's great.
Do you have anything coming up? Or are you doing anything? You still go to the studio, right? You have a studio every day,
and it's been a sanctuary for me all through the last several years, and so I'm constantly working, and I'm making, I do work that's very different from this. Individual objects that are much more one-off and have a dynamic that's internal to them as opposed to external like this. And so I'm constantly exploring different things, and there's always possibilities out there. And
so you make a point of going to the studio every day.
I don't. I force myself. I like it, And it's a fun commute, actually. Mm-hmm. Do it on a bicycle whenever I can. My son actually, we commute together. He has a job up there, a little bit north of UCSD. So lately, I've been getting there at 8 a.m. actually for about the last year. I've always had a studio that's away from wherever I live.
Yeah, I'm struggling with that. I think I talked to you about it once. I made the mistake of bringing my studio home, and I don't even want to look. I walk by the hallway. I like put my head down.
Well, I have a space at home that's a sort of a more office-like space, but it's like you were saying. I don't really do a lot of art there. It's great talking to you.
Yeah, Tom. I had such a great time, and I think we got some good stories, so thank you for doing it.
Great. You're more than welcome. Thank you for doing it.